located in Mahomet. That's our only underwriting or from Mahomet, I think. I don't know. There's a couple of new ones. Consider it. I was going to try and stay entirely on script, but it's hard for me. It's a retro barbershop, and yeah, offering professional haircuts and shaves. It's 601 East Main Street in Mahomet. So you live over that way, or you want to visit Mahomet, 217-855-9673, or on Facebook, or a Booksy app, I guess that's to make an appointment without calling. And we've got Urbana Arts and Culture, and I guess I'll play that from iMedia. What's the rundown? Well, Law and Disorder. I'm going to them for a couple of segments, and I'll be excerpting them on the fly. Stephen Jay of Real News, I think he got deleted from somewhere, maybe. Or maybe the organization got absorbed, did a CBS. I guess that's retro. CBS apparently cut away when the crowd in Milan booed Vance when he came on the screen. There are people out there trying to say that they booed the U.S. athletes, like I guess the Israeli athletes were booed, but yeah. But no, they were booing the screen and J.D. Vance. I didn't hear whether they negotiated the bringing of ICE agents along with that. I don't know how much cover there was in the regular U.S. media of the two Italian journalists in Minneapolis who were threatened with having their windows broken and being pulled out of the vehicle by some ICE agents after identifying themselves as press. They recorded it all pretty well, so it was available. And I saw it on CBC, which I've been going to more often from Canada, not just following the speech by their premier Carney at Davos, though I guess I went there more often after that. What can you do locally? 4 to 6 tomorrow at downtown Urbana, upstairs from one of our underwriters, the Cinema Gallery. There is a big, beautiful floor. It's the dance company. And from 4 to 6, there's a benefit in solidarity with Minneapolis. Dance, poetry, music, a raffle. Sure, there's always a way to directly donate. They'll have a list of organizations there, I guess, to choose to donate to, which there are many solidarity organizations. If you heard that rundown from the great Janine Jackson on FAIR, the faith community and local community organizers have kept their contacts from the George Floyd period. Oh, did I say Urbana Dance Company is 122 West Main Street? I did say it's about the gallery. Cinema gallery, the old movie house. Anyway, I'm getting to maunder on here. Did I finish the rundown? Law and Disorder, something about the various celebrations of the 250th anniversary of the revolution, I guess, 1776 to 26. There was a lot going on beforehand. I didn't know that, but Trump came in and derailed it. I really think that he thought that he could have the ballroom built in time to have his MMA final on July 4th. Is that right? Something it was going to be part of the celebration. Somehow appropriate, another sociopathic sport, which is my assessment of NFL football, where they, yeah. Last year's Super Bowl, I remember this distinctly because I was watching the African Cup football, soccer playoff, the final, and a billion people watched that, more than watch the NFL Super Bowl. But Yeah. So I've gone on much longer because I have so much material, and Mumia has been really prolific. I'm happy to hear that. I don't know if he's got a new way of recording with his low vision, but or maybe he's gotten treatment. I'm not sure. But he's got a piece on Fanon, and he has a piece on the stick-up in Venezuela, he calls it. He's got a longer piece about Venezuela that I won't get to. There's two different segments edited differently. And then he has a long discussion about the attack on black journalists with the Don Lemon and, is it Michelle Fort? Two people that were collected at that demo that happened at a church where the one of the ministers is moonlighting as an ICE executive. Interesting. But of the seven people that were arrested there, six of them were black. One of them was an outside agitator who's got a GoFundMe for getting around the country and going to anti-ICE events. Not George Soros funded, but anyway. So the other segment from Law and Disorder is about Jay Paul and the nuclear clock being moved. Jay Paul's working on a film. It was first going to be called a piece on the late great whistleblower Pentagon Papers guy who I'm having a brain fade on. Oh my gosh. Yeah, well, it's evolved to be a film about the threat of nuclear annihilation, which the guy whose name still hasn't come to me was consumed with. In fact, we know that he smuggled all these documents around Vietnam out of the Pentagon, but he was also smuggling out war planning, nuclear planning documents. And they had the idea of storing it in a refrigerator in a landfill. I think it was his brother's idea because he kept going out there trying to find it. I guess it was hit by a big storm and everything got washed away and they lost the papers that he had also purloined out of the Pentagon. He eventually went on to write a major book, and I'm still not getting his name. I should be Googling it. Well, I'll do that while I'm listening to Mumia Abu-Jamal. I think I'll play his two commentaries back to back to give me the moment I need here. Aphasia strikes deep, and I have to go through 3 hours today, so cut me some slack. I'm anchoring, as I mentioned, for Radio Free Labor with Furtados. I thought about asking about the DHS reorganization that happened 9/11. That was mentioned in the piece from Counterspin. That was a big union-busting phenomena, too, the way I remember it. I don't know if they recollect it the same way. A lot of DHS just came through and reorganized the government, you know, along the lines perhaps not quite as intensive as Trump has. A much too long soliloquy, almost 10 minutes, so here's Mumia.
My friends, I want to welcome all of you from the W.E.B. Du Bois Abolitionist School. And I invite you to hear my words about the late great revolutionary, Dr. Frantz Fanon, the gift of Fanon. When we think of, or even speak of, the great Algerian revolutionary, Dr. Frantz Fanon, the word gift doesn't immediately come to mind. But upon reflection on his immense contributions to the anti-colonialist struggles, perhaps that word, gift, will reemerge. Fanon, although born in the Caribbean island of Martinique, made global impact with his masterwork, the book, The Wretched of the Earth. In it, he wrote powerful truths about the Algerian struggle for liberation from the French Empire and the continuing struggle for African freedom and liberation from colonialism. If Anand provides any gifts for us, I think these that follow are soul food for the freedom struggles of today. First, his riveting message about the nature of colonialism, which is, of course, a present war, but also a war against history itself. Fanon wrote, and I quote, "Colonialism is not satisfied with snaring the people in the net or of draining the colonized brain of any form or substance. With a kind of perverted logic, it turns its attention to the past of the colonized people and distorts it, disfigures it, and destroys it." Fanon. Why does the colonizer destroy the people's history? Simple. Destroy the past, and you destroy the present. This gives you some sense of the power and value and worth of history. Here is his second gift, his message to the young people. Again, we turn to the pages of The Wretched of the Earth, where he writes, "Each generation must discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it in relative opacity." The question becomes, for each generation, what is your mission? Will you fulfill it or betray it? The words of the revolutionary thinker and worker, Dr. Frantz Fanon, "With Love Not Fear, this is Mumia Abu Jamal."
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Okay, I said I was going to play them both together, but I did remember Daniel Ellsberg while I was Googling it. I didn't know Spielberg made a film in 2017 dramatizing the Pentagon Papers issue. And I don't understand why it was called The Post. Because it was the New York Times. There isn't a Washington Post anymore. That's what the slogan, "Democracy Dies in Darkness," really means. Amazon is the darkness. You know, they weren't making money for a long time on their, what everybody identifies as their trade. They were subsidizing their decimation of bricks and mortar stores by having big contracts with the government, notably the CIA, curiously enough. In my rundown, I also didn't mention Greg Palast is back with an election crimes bulletin. He was in the Chicagoland region, which I guess he originally originates from, though he lived all over the world. Stringer for the BBC, lived in the UK for a while, has kids with a UK accent for a while. They probably lost it by now. But also did the film on the coup against Chavez, etc. He's sort of the Zelig of gonzo journalism. If that makes any sense. Let's hear another Mumia commentary. And I also haven't heard this one, and it drops Venezuela into the mix.
"Hey, Venezuela, this is a stick up. It is time for all of us to say what we see right before us. An empire attacks a poor, weaker state and demands the lion's share of its richest raw material, oil. Why is this not a stick up? They demand it and get it. Remember that old corny line from the movies, your money or your life? Here, it's give me your oil or else. Or, even worse perhaps, this oil is ours. We're taking most of it. Really? Honestly? Doesn't that sound straight up like a stick-up? And as if that wasn't enough, the seizure of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores was and is a kidnapping. Think of this, okay? When have you heard of U.S. presidents waging unjust wars on false and specious pretexts? We need think no further than the hellish wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, where tens of thousands of people died under grotesque U.S. bombing campaigns. Remember weapons of mass destruction? Now, who got busted for that disaster? Maduro and his wife are not subject to American law. They should be returned home, period, immediately. And the natural resources of Venezuela should remain in the hands of the people of Venezuela, not the Americans. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
And you can find some more. I haven't even played all of the ones that he's done in the last week. I guess the Post did print the Pentagon Papers first, but the lawsuit was about the New York Times. That's curious. Well, maybe Paul Jay will sort some of that out. I don't think so. Let's get to the intrepid journalist, Greg Palast, on the election beat. Had a piece at the beginning of the week, but I don't think some of his points are ever treated in regular press, regular media. Again, he was in Hinsdale in Chicagoland on Thursday screening the Vigilante film, which is viewable online. I guess some of those Hollywood leftists helped out with that. I think Capria spent some money on it as well as... anyway, you can find that at gregpalast.com.
You along, and we are happy to welcome back our old friend Greg Palast. You remember the election crimes bulletin? Well, Greg's got another piece out today. We wanted to get right to him because, as usual, he is right on the mark where the corporate media is somewhere out in left field. Let me read you a little bit about what Greg writes today. For God's sake, let's get to the real agenda behind Wednesday's FBI raid on the Fulton County Elections Office. It's not about the 2020 election. The Warren says the FBI wants the envelopes from the 2020 election to hunt for crimes, but that's just the legal excuse for stormtrooping. Greg says this is all about 2026 and 2028. Greg Palast, welcome back to Flashpoints. Let's maybe give us a first response to this, the big news story, and then let's get into the crucial aspects of the story, which have everything to do with Fulton County, Black Atlanta, and ultimately we're going to get to drop boxes. So lay this out for us.
All right. So we had an FBI raid on Fulton County Elections Office. Fulton County, which you probably know, is the center of the city of Atlanta, Black Atlanta. It's Trump's claim, you know, that he won the 2020 election and the theft was at the center of the so-called theft was Fulton County, that black voters were stuffing ballot boxes. So, but it's not about Trump trying to prove that he really won the 2020 election. That's how the national media played it. But I will say that the local elections activists that I've been speaking to, you know, whether it's Reverend Jesse Jackson, Gerald Griggs of the Georgia NAACP and Black Voters Matter Fund, this is not about 2020. This is about basically stealing, bending the 2026 election and the 2028 election. Right now, understand what's at stake here. John Ossoff is running for re-election. Progressive Democrat who, you know, they are gunning for. They can't. He has like a 70% approval rating. It's amazing. They can't win by getting convincing people to vote against Ossoff because it's just not there in the polls. What they can do is stop people from voting. And which people? People of color and students and also the kind of progressives and LGBTQ community of Atlanta. How are they doing this? What does this have to do with seizing these ballots, Dennis? Well, it goes back to a film we've discussed called 2000 Mules, created by a group called True the Vote. The film was launched at Mar-a-Lago, and it claims that Mark Zuckerberg and George Soros paid black men, and they emphasize that it's all black men, $10 for every illegal ballot they stuffed into a drop box in Atlanta. Now, understand at the that which is an interesting combination of anti-Semitism and racism, you know. And the reason I'm laughing is what person would take $10 to commit a felony crime on camera, because every single drop box has a camera on it that identifies the voter. Furthermore, every ballot, people, if you look at your California mail-in ballot, you'll see a barcode on the outside. That is specific to you. When Dennis, you get your ballot, the Dennis Bernstein barcode. If someone else votes it and there's a picture of someone else dropping it off, that ballot, that person's committed a felony crime, they will get arrested. It's very easy to catch someone who tries to pull that stunt. So the Republicans, Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, and Brian Kemp, they kind of forced Fulton County. They reviewed every single ballot in the drop box, something like 70,000 ballots. They reviewed those 70,000 ballots one by one, identified the barcodes, identified the signatures on the envelope, matched them to the registration signatures. There wasn't one single unaccounted for ballot, not one single bit of evidence that anyone cast an extra ballot, because you can't. You have to put on a special barcode. And besides, why would someone take $10 to commit this crime on a camera when you could just put a 50-cent stamp on the darn thing and stick it in the mailbox when no one's looking? But, you know, that's getting, you know, it's hard to argue with crazy. But the problem is, this ain't crazy. Because what they have done is now we get to the come down on this. All right, it's phony that they're illegal alien voters, that they're 2,000 mules. That's what they call the black men, that there were 2,000 black men, the mules, carrying out this crime. Because what they want to do, and they've already done a damn good job of it, is eliminate early voting, drop box voting, mail-in voting.
Let me jump in here, Greg, and let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are delighted to be welcoming Greg Palast back. We're talking about Trump's seizure of ballots and information in Atlanta, sort of a throwdown. Now, I want you to talk more about this, Greg. It's crucial. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't you say the corporate press, after all now, Trump's been elected twice, that the corporate press has underestimated and mischaracterized Trump in this context? Like, Trump's a bungling idiot and he's not here?
Yeah, no, he's not. He's crazy like a fox. I mean, and I will say that Mark Elias, who is a nominally a lawyer for the Democratic Party, also said this was about 26 and 28, but no Democratic leaders, and certainly none of the mainstream media. It's all about, oh, crazy Trump, he just wants to prove he won 2020. That's not what's at stake. So here's a fact we need to know to get somewhere. 70% of African Americans vote early, either using a ballot drop box, a mail-in ballot, or in-person early voting. And in without the drop boxes, Trump would have won Georgia. And the only reason he won in 2024 is that under SB 202, which was passed after Biden took Georgia, and if you remember also in that same election, you had Ossoff and Democratic Senator Reverend Warnock won election. So you had a Democratic wipeout they wiped out the GOP in Georgia. It could not have been done without a massive use of drop boxes in Atlanta. But in 24, they cut the number the state cut the number of drop boxes in Atlanta and Savannah, the two big black cities. They cut them by 75%, saying that you had to, by 75%, there was one drop box for each 100,000 voters. Can you imagine? So that slashed the number of early voters in the black community. Yes. Plus, they put away the drop box at 5 o'clock when the inside buildings. The whole point of Dropbox is that you can go 24/7. You're a doctor working at a hospital. And so what happened was between, for example, the 2020 election and the 2022 election, after the new law came in, they cut the days of early voting. They cut your access to the ballot drop boxes in particular. They cut mail-in voting access a number of days. The result was that, and the mainstream press totally missed this, the number of votes dropped from 1.1 million votes in, 1.2 million votes, which were mailed in and put in drop boxes, to 0.2 million. In other words, they lost 83% of the mail-in vote, and that was crucial to Trump winning in 2024 because they made it so difficult. And the thing is, Dennis, whatever is test-driven in Georgia, we've talked about this many times, which is why I keep going to Georgia. Whatever the test drive in Georgia goes nationwide, after SB 202 passed, 30 states passed laws restricting drop boxes and mail-in balloting. And they did that with the excuse that they were trying to stop this so-called voter fraud, even though, again, they didn't find one fraudulent ballot. In fact, in this film 2000 Mules, which Trump has been promoting, you see Charlie Kirk. Remember that guy? Charlie Kirk. I'm not going to say anything other than he was in that film with some other right-wing jokers watching what they watched a black man putting ballots in a mailbox. You'll see this in my film, Vigilantes, Inc., by the way. And putting ballots in a drop box, one drops on the ground, he sticks it in, and then he hustles back to his car. And these people are saying, you're looking at O.J. running from the scene of a crime. It's because he's a black man putting ballots in a box. It turns out, the guy that they kept showing again and again, it's a guy named Mark Andrews. He's a Verizon executive in Atlanta, and he was legally dropping off his and his family's ballots, his daughter's and his wife's ballots, which is legal under Georgia law. But it was a black man sticking ballots in a drop box, so obviously he's committing a crime. And that's the game that's being played here. And it's dangerous, and they're trying to grab these ballots so they can look at, so the feds can look once again at the barcodes, at the signatures, etc., and say, aha, these are illegal ballots. But, you know, again, I don't trust them because they physically carted off these things, but they've been reviewed by Fulton and by the GOP executives of that state, who would have loved, Brian Kemp, the governor, would have loved to hand the state to Trump, but he wasn't going to wear an orange suit. Remember, let's not forget that Trump, with this game, was charged with felonious racketeering. You know, Fani Willis, the Fulton County prosecutor, screwed it up because of her personal stuff. But, you know, Brian Kemp really didn't want to wear an orange suit for Donald Trump.
Now, we have to say, Greg, that this what we're talking about now, this issue, what's happening in Atlanta, again, we can't overstate the fact that this has everything to do whether the Trump neo-fascists are going to control the future, or there is going to be something close to an election that allows for a fair, you know, electoral process for a candidate. This is the heart of the matter, right? And the corporate Republican Democrats aren't all that interested in this story.
Well, remember, if everyone gets to vote, Dennis, you're going to have a very, very different set of candidates who are going to be elected in primaries. The incumbents ain't going to do too well if everyone got the vote. If you didn't have bias in voting against the poor, people of color, students, you'd have a very different electorate and therefore a very different elected official. So the current Democratic Party is not exactly favorable to this action. In fact, I can't tell you in my career how much trouble and strife I've gotten from the Democratic Party. They've tried to shut me down many times. They say, don't talk about vote suppression. I know it sounds crazy because it's their voters in the main that are being suppressed. But Trump is using Viktor Orban, the prime minister of Hungary, as his model. And he doesn't have to call off elections. People are worried about calling off the 26 or 28 elections. All you have to do is make it so bent that you do it like Hungary, where you have such control over the voting in the courts that it, you know, it's just a pretend election. They're not going to call it off. People go in the streets for that. But Americans, as long as they're given, you know, allowed to pretend, it's like having, you know, when you're a kid and you've got that little kiddie seat with the wheel and you can pretend you're driving. Well, you can pretend you're voting. But they can't steal all the votes all the time. So I tell everyone, don't steal your own vote by not voting. Fight for that vote.
Right.
But there's a couple of other things that they are doing with this. You know, it's a triple threat, this grabbing of the Fulton files. Number one, they're bringing back our old friend, for those of you who saw my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, they're bringing back interstate cross-check. This is from an executive order by Donald Trump. So if they get these records, they want the registration records, they want to prove that Jose Garcia, who lives in Atlanta, voted, and a Jose Garcia who lives in Texas voted. Obviously, it's the same guy voting twice. And you say, well, Jose Garcia, I mean, that's just a common Hispanic name. They say, well, it's not necessarily common for Republicans. So they're coming, bringing this back. We thought we had defeated this, Dennis, by working lawsuits brought by the ACLU, Black Voters Matter, NAACP. I was an expert witness in those cases, and it was done. We thought we'd whacked this one on the head. It's back. Now, and there's a third one, Dennis, you'll love this, and this connects with ICE. There is something, I don't want to get the name wrong offhand, but I believe it's called the START program, database, which is the database of all the people that Homeland Security has deported, discovered to be illegally, they get deported. Once again, we go back to Jose Garcia, who gets deported back to Salvador, and then they find a Jose Garcia voting in Miami. Oh, well, obviously, Jose Garcia swam back from Salvador to across the Caribbean to Miami to vote. And the last time they did this, Dennis, you know, look, if you're not an American citizen, don't vote. It's a crime. They don't, because last time they tried to use the deportation list database against the voting roll was in Florida in during the Obama administration. Court ordered Obama to turn over these deportation records. They removed 179,000 people from the voter rolls of Florida, almost all of them Hispanic. They removed those people, and now they were allowed to get back on the rolls. All they had to do was take a day off work, go to a federal court, and prove to a judge that they are who they are and that they're an American citizen. And so, but it is a felony crime. How many people went to jail? Of the 179,000 voters, how many were actually convicted of the crime of voting while a non-citizen? The answer, Dennis, I won't make you guess, is one. One, an Austrian Republican who went to prison, by the way, for 10 years.
You said an Austrian Republican, huh?
Yeah.
An Austrian Republican, yeah.
Well, so what's happened is that, again, using racial profiling, and now the Supreme Court has authorized this. You know, go ahead and look through the voter rolls for everyone named Hernandez, everyone named Levy, and wipe them out, because you can now, the Supreme Court has authorized racial and ethnic profiling. And it doesn't just stop at looking at someone in a car. Your profile is in your name. This is what's coming to us. It's not about 2020, my friends. It is about 26 and 28. And by the way, I will be having a virtual showing of Vigilantes Inc. And you can see my whole breakdown of 2,000 Mules within that film. It's a film within a film. I do the whole breakdown. And I'll be doing that next Thursday for Indivisible Nationwide, and it will be based out of Chicago live. So if you're in Chicago, go to Greg Powell's website and you can come into the live or watch online. That'll be 4:30 Pacific.
Beautiful. And Greg, last we spoke many months ago, we last election, we were talking about another level of intimidation, sort of physical intimidation, the making illegal bringing water to somebody who is waiting online to vote in a very difficult weather condition. Are those kinds of structures still in place, or were they to be unconstitutional?
No, they're totally. See, one of the excuses that they hide behind, even though the feds are moving in, is that it's all up, that voting in the Constitution, the procedures and processes up to each state. as long as it doesn't violate other parts of the Constitution, like the 14th Amendment, which we thought protected us. 14th Amendment, which used to be about equal protection for people of color, that's why it was there, has just become a cover for corporate so-called personhood. So we have the problem that the 14th Amendment has now been bastardized into a corporate protection plan, but the whole point of it was actually they were thinking very much about voting, that you can't take away someone's vote because of their color of their skin or that they were previously enslaved. That is a problem. So we have in Georgia, for example, in SB 202, we really have the strengthening of the law that says if you give someone a bottle of water while waiting in line, you have to understand Georgia can be, you know, 100% humidity, and you got elderly people waiting in line, and you can't give a bottle of water, you can't give them any food. It's a felony, and they mean it, and I can tell you that I was there. And that type of thing is spreading. Again, the closing of the drop boxes in places like Texas, for example. Ken Paxton, who's now running for Senate, he is the attorney. He is the attorney general, who was, by the way, impeached for corruption. But he's now running for Senate. And he bragged. He bragged. You'll see this in Vigilantes, in my film. He bragged that that if he hadn't stopped mailing out ballots to the people of Houston, which has the largest black population of any city in America, if he didn't stop 2.5 million ballots going out to Houston voters during COVID, that Donald Trump would have lost Texas. That's Texas, Dennis. They can't hold Texas if they didn't use this trickery. It is very serious. Don't ask the Democratic Party to take care of you on this. They're getting a little slightly more savvy. Certainly people like John Ossoff, who I've known for a long time, is very, very savvy about this. So is Reverend Warnock. I've talked to him about this. Georgia, the problem is that if they get away with it in Georgia, it looks like they are. Next is Minnesota. They want those lists. It's a swing state. Michigan's a swing state. They want those lists. They want them from Illinois. You've got governors resisting, but Texas was thrilled to hand over its voter rolls to the justice, so-called Justice Department. It's really, you know, and if you want more info on this, by the way, just go to gregpalace.com or my Substack, Greg Palace Investigates on Substack.
I have to tell you, Greg, your earlier film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, really was so cutting edge and so clear about how essentially these elections would be transformed if people really had the right to vote. But it doesn't seem like it's going in the right direction. We have 30 seconds. What's the final note for today?
Well, actually, go watch The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. It's actually quite entertaining. At gregpalace.com, you can get that link through for free and stream it. And because to be informed, it's just like you want to be aware that there's a pickpocket around and watch your pockets. And the other final thing is don't throw away your own vote. Please check your registration 60 days before the election. Make sure you haven't been purged, blocked, challenged. There's so much more for us to go over. And so I guess we're back in the Election Crimes Bulletin, like it or not.
All right. Thank you, Greg, for taking the time out for us today. We know you got a lot on the plate. Stay safe. Come back soon. You're always welcome here.
Thank you, Dennis. Bye.
All right. You're listening to Flash.
Okay. And, you know, it was a regular feature that I played every week for many different election cycles. And he'll come back. He's Palace is on with not John Hartman. What is that fellow that's on AM? You have to sign a contract with him to excerpt him. He does circulate his stuff on Pacifica and community stations, and I'm having aphasia about him. Tom with an H, Hartman. He's good on as is Palace on these election issues. I have some other disagreements, but I don't want to meander on because I have 2 half-hour segments and only 20 minutes left to play. So I think I better pick one. These are both from Law and Disorder. By the way, Kathy Kelly was on that same segment. What is the date on that Palace piece? It was early in the week. It was the 29th of February, so longer than a week. Kathy Kelly. From Chicagoland as well. I didn't know it was an indivisible nationwide sponsored view, but as you can watch Best Democracy Money Can Buy from a link on his website, you can also get the link out of the latest article which collects the thoughts that he was just talking about there. I'm torn. Perhaps the one with a colleague of Law and Disorder, actually he's co-host some of the time, but he's done some work about the 250th anniversary, and maybe I can get to the nuclear issue tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock. Again, 4 to 6, so at the Urbana Dance Company, there's a fundraiser for Solidarity with Minneapolis. I have a listing of a variety of community organizations there, and you can donate to the one that you want. A lot of discussion, poetry. Where is that picture? Solidarity with Minneapolis. Art. And, of course, dance. It's a big dance floor. It was put in for a karate club or something. But now it's dedicated to dance in downtown Urbana. And I'm still deliberating here, cogitating. I don't know why I do this. Yeah, let's do the one on celebrating the 250th anniversary of the revolution. Obviously, I have a dissident view on the revolution as well. I think there's some untold stories, untold even in 9 hours by the documentarist Burns. So I'm around for Radio Free Labor, so maybe I'll get some of these other points in. But I think I'm gonna kind of just run the board. I'll be sitting in seat for Bob Polesny, late and still lamented, missed a lot. I'll save that for a WEFT quarterly meeting, perhaps. Heidi Bogosian,
author on issues of civil liberties.
Michael Smith.
2026 is the 250th anniversary of signing of the Declaration of Independence and the founding of the United States of America. Festivities and events are being organized all over the country all year long. Here at Law and Disorder, we intend to invite guests throughout the year who can help us explore the founding of our country in a way that is truthful, authentic, and comprehensive. But like so much else in these dangerous times, Donald Trump is ruining this rare opportunity to celebrate the enduring values of pluralism, justice, and equality on which this country was founded. Instead, Trump is enlisting the entire federal government and billions of public and private dollars into converting this national anniversary into an opportunity to whitewash American history, pursuing his obsession to destroy diversity, equity, and inclusion, crushing institutions like the Smithsonian Museums that for 175 years has served as, quote, a welcoming place of knowledge and discovery for all Americans, and imposing his reactionary vision of white Christian nationalism. Seeing how Trump is already exploiting the 250th anniversary of the founding by peddling his distorted version of American history, our very own co-host Steve Rohde has been investigating what Trump is doing and how the rest of us need to redouble our efforts to immerse ourselves and the American people in an accurate and comprehensive account of our history. Stephen Rohde is a writer, lecturer, and political activist. For almost 50 years, he practiced civil rights, civil liberties, and intellectual property law. He is a past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He is a founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, a member of the board of directors of Death Penalty Focus, and a member of the Black Jewish Justice Alliance. He is the special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Stephen is the author of the book American Words of Freedom, The Words That Define Our Nation, and Freedom of Assembly, as well as numerous articles and book reviews on civil liberties and constitutional history. Stephen, welcome to the guest seat on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much, Heidi. I'm very pleased to be with you in this role today.
Stephen, plans to celebrate the 250th anniversary of this country have been in the works well before Trump took office. Tell us what those plans look like before he got his hands on them.
Yes, originally the plans to celebrate the 250th commemoration were launched by President Barack Obama in 2016. He signed an act of Congress creating a bipartisan United States semi-quincentennial commission. The first set of commissioners were a highly diverse group of Democrats and Republicans, including 8 members of Congress, 16 private citizens, 9 federal officials. And in 2018, Rosa Guantoyo Rios, a Mexican-American business leader who had served as the 43rd treasurer of the United States under Obama, was named a commissioner. And in July 2022, President Joe Biden appointed her to chair the commission. So it was in the works. It was fully bipartisan, but that's changed.
Yes, we know that bipartisan congressional commissions are not a Trump thing. So tell us what he's planning and how it contrasts with what has been underway for nearly 10 years.
Well, as we've seen all year, within about a week after taking office the second time, on January 29 last year, by executive order, he established his own separate White House task force on celebrating America's 250th birthday. This is known as the Task Force 250. Of course, he appointed himself as chair and Vice President J.D. Vance as vice chair. Trump granted himself the power to appoint an executive director. And to ensure that Task Force 250 was securely anchored within the Republican Party, he stacked the initial task force with 14 Republicans that he had previously appointed in his administration and the heads of other executive departments as he may choose to invite to participate. The official bipartisan commission, the one appointed by Obama, will play no official part in Task Force 250. It may be, quote, invited to provide recommendations and advice. Trump also reinstated Executive Order 13978, which he had issued during his first term, titled Building the National Garden of American Heroes. Biden had canceled that immediately after he became president. In Trump's executive order, he complained that across the nation, quote, belief in the greatness and goodness of America has come under attack in recent months and years by a dangerous anti-American extremism that seeks to dismantle our country's history, institutions, and very identity. This is the theme. We'll be hearing it throughout this conversation. He speaks in those terms when he is the one who is dismantling our history, our institutions, and our very identity.
You know, Steve, I can't help but notice that Task Force 250 sounds like a military operation.
You're right.
Trump's made his true intentions quite apparent in a subsequent March 27, 2025 executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. Tell us about that.
Yes, whatever whitewashing, if you will, of his initial declaration, this one is Trump on steroids. He complained that over the past decade, quote, Americans have witnessed a concerted and widespread effort to rewrite our national history, replacing objective facts with a distorted narrative driven by ideology rather than truth. You know, in what Trump does, there's always a lot of projection of his own motives he then attributes to others. In this executive order, he accused this, quote, revisionist movement of undermining the remarkable achievements of the United States by casting founding principles and milestones in a negative light. You're going to see that a lot. True history for him is negative because it tells the truth. He accused this movement of reconstructing American history, quote, as inherently racist, sexist, oppressive, or otherwise irredeemably flawed. Well, that's the point. He wants to remove any history of racism, sexism, oppression, and have this prettified history that is literally pure white. He accused the Biden administration of advancing a corrosive ideology because they sponsored, he gave an example, there was a training at the Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia. This was under the Biden administration, in which there was a training speaking about dismantling Western foundations and interrogating institutional racism. You know, those, of course, are what a healthy country should do. But Trump condemned them, and he condemned the Smithsonian Institute for coming under the, quote, influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology that promotes, quote, narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. You know, whenever I see language like that, that our side is introducing a race-centered ideology. The race-centered ideology at the heart of our nation was introduced by slavery and the annihilation of Native Americans. They introduced race into this country in such a terrible way. And when we try to tell that story and overcome the white supremacist narrative, then we are accused of divisiveness. That's what we're really up against in the 250th under Trump.
Well, in one case related to the museum, Trump criticized the Smithsonian American Art Museum for mounting the exhibit called The Shape of Power, Stories of Race in American Sculpture, that asserts that, quote, societies including the United States have used race to establish and maintain systems of power, privilege, and disenfranchisement. End quote. The exhibit further explains that, quote, sculpture has been a powerful tool in promoting scientific racism and promotes the view that race is not a biological reality but a social construct, stating, quote, race is a human invention. How has Trump targeted the Smithsonian specifically?
Yes, this is ongoing. It's current as we speak, and I'll discuss that. And it's a very dangerous approach to our American history, going after this esteemed set of multiple museums that make up the Smithsonian and that has been at this work for 175 years. Trump declared that it's the policy of his administration to restore federal sites dedicated to history, including solemn and uplifting public monuments that remind Americans of our extraordinary heritage and the like. But in the very same breath, his executive order had the audacity to announce that henceforth museums in our national capital, quote, should be places where individuals go to learn, not to be subjected to ideological indoctrination or divisive narratives that distort or shared history, our shared history, unquote. I mean, he is saying out loud exactly what he's doing. So he empowered Vance. Now, the vice president, all vice presidents in recent memory have a role as a member of the Smithsonian Board of Regents. That's a job, one of the jobs the vice president has. Well, that has never been as weaponized as it is now. So Vance sits on that board, and under this executive order, he is instructed to work with Congress to ensure that future appropriations to the Smithsonian Institute, quote, prohibit expenditure on exhibits that, quote, degrade shared American values, quote, divide Americans based on race, or promote programs or ideologies inconsistent with federal law and policy. Well, they are moving ahead on this. Last August, three Trump officials sent a long letter to Lonnie G. Bunch III, secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, and they launched an internal review of all Smithsonian exhibits and materials. To celebrate the 250th, they told Bunch that it's important, more important than ever, that our national museums reflect the unity, progress, and enduring values They told the Smithsonian to follow the Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History executive order, which I quoted earlier. This review is breathtakingly wide and intrusive. It will focus on all exhibition text, wall didactics, websites, educational material, digital and social media. They will interview curators and senior staff to interrogate them on whether they are following the president's mission. And it will be done in consistent with guidelines set by the president rather than the independent guidelines that have driven the Smithsonian ever since it was established.
Stephen, in conjunction with the online publication LA Progressive, as contributing editor, you're planning a year-to-year look at the Declaration of Independence. The series is titled All Men Are Created Equal, Hypocrisy or Hope? Your upcoming inaugural article in LA Progressive recommends that one of the best ways to celebrate the 250th anniversary is to recall the words of Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Give us a sample of how they viewed the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, in launching this program, and I'm so grateful to Dick Price and Sharon Kyle of LA Progressive for being open to having some of their most talented writers across this year devoted to these serious questions. You know, was our founding document mere hypocrisy written by slave owners, or is it an essential expression of aspirations and hope that the people have struggled to breathe life into for the last 250 years? And I've said this in groups that I'm active in with Indivisible and the ACLU and others. We cannot just be against what Trump is doing in this 250th anniversary in particular, but more broadly in his entire fascist agenda, just to be against what he's doing. We have to be for something. We have to be in favor of a vision, in this case, of American history. And we have to offer readers and listeners and the American people alternatives. We have to be the ones to demonstrate the comprehensive, complex nature of American history. And I couldn't think of starting at a better place than Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. They understood the complexities of American history. They were the victims of the most oppressive aspects of that history. Yet they could tenaciously believe that America was founded upon indelible revolutionary principles. And they insisted that the American government and the American people live up to those principles. And I think that's exactly what we need to be doing this whole year and frankly, every year. So I went back, and of course, those three towering figures are not the only ones, and I hope in local libraries and community events and on July 4th itself and elsewhere throughout this year, everybody seek out examples of the kinds of visionary leaders that these three individuals represent. I went back and looked at an extraordinary speech that Frederick Douglass gave called What to a Slave is the 4th of July.
That is a good one, and Amy Goodman plays that every 4th of July. Stand by, we're at the top of the hour, going into Radio Free Labor, and we're fired up and we're going to cut loose, at least, well, I'm going to run the board. Anyway, let's do an underwriting announcement, and then we'll kick it with the theme. And yeah, thanks for supporting community media. This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored and volunteer-operated radio.
Support for WEFT Radio comes from Urbana Arts and Culture, providing resources such as arts grants, artist opportunities, events, and other arts and culture programming. Since 2008, the program fosters a city where all residents may engage with the arts and where artists thrive and are valued. The City of Urbana's Arts and Culture program continues to celebrate Urbana's artistic and cultural diversity. More information can be found at urbanail.gov or on facebook.com/urbanapublicarts.
And I did want to mention